Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Monday, June 1st, 2020. Producing from his home studio in Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. This is a baseball podcast, but there is so much going on in our country, too important to go forward without acknowledgement. The protests and the riots in the aftermath of George Floyd's death. The most moving thing I saw over the weekend was from rapper Killer Mike speaking at a press conference during the rioting in Atlanta. Give a listen.
So I'm duty bound to be here to simply say that it is your duty not to burn your own house down for anger with an enemy. It is your duty to fortify your own house so that you may be a house of refuge in times of organization. And now is the time to plot, plan, strategize, organize, and mobilize. It is time to beat up prosecutors you don't like at the voting booth. It is time to hold mayoral offices accountable, chiefs and deputy chiefs. Atlanta is not perfect, but we're a lot better than we ever were, and we're a lot better than cities are. I'm mad as hell. I woke up wanting to see the world burn down yesterday because I'm tired of seeing black men die.
We've seen athletes respond to this. Among those, Mets first baseman Pete Alonso posted this on Instagram. For the past couple of days, I've struggled to wrap my mind around what's happening. I have a voice and I will not remain silent. My heart has been broken over the murder of George Floyd. I will never know what it feels like to be discriminated against because of the color of my skin. To anyone who faces this type of discrimination, I will fight for you and be an ally. I will always stand with you. There needs to be justice and change made for the better of humanity. Let words be our sword and unity be our armor. Take care of each other. Dale Murphy, the longtime outfielder for the Atlanta Braves, tweeted out that his son was shot in the eye with a rubber bullet while peacefully protesting for justice for George Floyd. Dale wrote, his story is not unique. Countless others have also experienced this use of excessive police force while trying to have their voices heard. Luckily, his eye was saved due to a kind stranger that was handing out goggles to protesters shortly before the shooting and another kind stranger that drove him to the ER. Others were not so lucky and will be permanently disabled due to the excessive force of police. We'll continue to have that conversation about America's pain in this podcast and days ahead. Meanwhile, on matters of far less gravity, the negotiation between Major League Baseball and the Players Association to start the 2020 season continue. Jeff Passan reported last night that the players forwarded a counterproposal on Sunday in which they suggested a 114-game season from June 30th to October 31st, which, as Jeff wrote, is expected to be immediately dismissed by the league. The union remains steadfast that players should receive their full prorated salaries. The union did suggest possible salary deferrals and acknowledgement by the players that amid the coronavirus pandemic and unrest, cash flow issues could prove problematic for the owners. The players' proposal also included the idea of an expanded playoffs for 2 years. Major League Baseball's proposal suggests 1 year of a postseason that goes from 10 teams to 14, a salary advance of $100 million to split among players during the second spring training, additional commitments to players wearing microphones in the field and other broadcast enhancement, and there was an offer to hold events such as an off-season All-Star game or Home Run Derby to generate additional revenue. This was a hopeful development. Sean Doolittle, the Nationals reliever, tweeted out that the Washington Major Leaguers will provide salary relief to minor leaguers who saw their salaries cut last week. Jeff Passan covers baseball for ESPN. And Jeff, we just went through the details of your report from last night. I think the most important question this morning is, what's next?
That's a great question, Buster, because I think what's next is going to be the most important element of this entire thing. And that is, what's the reaction of owners after the union's first proposal? And I think you did a great job in your Sunday Notes column of pointing out the fragility of this on account of there being owners who don't want to play in 2020. If this proposal angers the league side and owners in particular enough where what is a relatively small block of owners now suddenly starts to gain a little bit of political traction in trying to convince some of the more moderate owners that this is a lost cause and it's just not worth playing the 2020 season, then I think they're actually in trouble. But if the door being cracked open for deferrals, which it was done in this proposal, leads to something more substantive and productive, I think something can come together on relative quick order, because that's how it has to. Like, if they want to play this year, something needs to get done this week. And it's on owners right now to come back and really facilitate that after the players offer.
Jeff, I'm glad that they're talking. I mean, it's a good thing if they're talking, because there's been so much time that's passed in the last three and a half years since the CBA of 2016 in which they haven't been talking. But my God, they are so far apart. It's incredible to me that this was shut down like March 12th, 13th. And yet it still feels like that, to use the football comparison, it's like we're at the 1 yard line. There's about 58 seconds to go and they're 99 yards a field ahead of them. When you're talking about the financial issues, the safety protocol, and then the challenge of pulling everything together, which I'm sure you're hearing the same thing from general managers that I am, like, this is not something you can just execute overnight.
No, and regarding that latter part, I think that they have known for a while now what the expectations are going to be. And I know some general managers that I've talked with have said they're trying to get their facilities in order. So, you know, the secondary clubhouses and a lot of the things that are in the health and safety protocol, they've at least been trying to start. But let's look at the logistics of getting everybody around the country right now. Between COVID and the civil unrest that's going on, traveling's not going to be particularly easy, and getting people from place to place, city to city. You don't even know where you're going half the time when it comes to either getting to the city or are you going to be at your spring training facility? I mean, these are all open questions right now. But I would say instead of the 1 yard line, you've got like both sides in their tunnels right now or in their locker rooms. I mean, that is how far apart they are. And the biggest question to me has been, what does the path to a deal look like?
Yep.
What does an actual compromise between these two sides that both are going to be, if not happy with, then willing to agree to? And I don't see it. I don't see it, and I've been chalking that up to the fact that I'm not as smart as the people who were involved in these negotiations and not as creative as them, maybe. But that being said, in order to bridge the gap that they have right now, there better be a lot of intelligence and a lot of creativity going on by two sides that to this point have been defined by their stubbornness.
And I'd say this, too. I think that there's a point of contention that needs to be resolved for everybody, not only for public consumption, but I think for the players in particular, is this whole question of what was agreed to in the March 26 deal, where, they reached the agreement. And within days, we got the statement from Tony Clark and words that have been echoed by Scott Boras, individual players from time to time, that the owners agreed that if games were played, regardless of whether or not there were fans in the stands, that the players would be paid their prorated salaries. I'm sure you got the same voices that I got, where right away management was saying, that's not what we agreed to. Now, they didn't do it as loudly as Tony did and as Scott did. And then 2 weeks ago, Joel Sherman of the New York Post wrote an article in which he presented some documentation on management side, which seemed to support the contention that if, in fact, there were games played without fans in the stands, that there would be more negotiations, which, of course, would run completely counter to what Tony has said in statements and what Scott has been saying, Scott having influence in particular with his clients. And I think it's really important as we move forward for the union leadership, if it has documentation to support the position that it's had, that it needs to present that and to let the players know that they're actually standing on concrete, because that premise to me, Jeff, has been such a bottleneck in these conversations. What do you think?
It has. And I, you know, as much as we want to look back at that late March agreement, I wonder if this is just a more simple thing where players are going to realize that to get a deal done, they're not going to get full pro rata. Like I know they don't want to show their hand at this point, but I think any person who's looking at this rationally understands that the owners simply will not agree to a deal without a full pro rata. And look, if the players want to make that the hill that they die on, that Buster is when there needs to be whether it's seeking of all legal advice or outside legal opinion on the matter, or the possibility even of a grievance. And if a grievance were to happen, what sort of communication would there have been? What would be found in discovery? These are all questions that are worth asking of the players, because this has been a hill that the leadership at the union is not just willing to die on, but has used as a rallying point for the players, and something around which they have gathered and drawn strength from. So it becomes at some point a matter of pragmatism versus, I don't even know if idealism is the right word, as much as it is standing up for the cause that you believe in and feeling like this is a righteous thing for the players to be doing. And I was talking with one player earlier this week, and he was saying the union has made no great gains in the past without standing firm for what we believe in. And this offer, it was pretty illustrative of that, because they went from 82 games at a severe pay cut from MLB's offer to 114 games at full pro rata, knowing that the league, the owners, the clubs simply were not going to agree with it. This was as much of a non-starter for the league as the league's offer was for the players.
There were, in the great details you had in your report, there were two interesting threads, and maybe I'm over analyzing this, but at this point, after watching years of this back and forth, you see little fig leaves, or peace offerings that come out, and there were two that were interesting to me. Was the notion of deferral, and you were the first one to mention this to me in a private conversation that we had, the possibility of that. Because that would seem to be, the smallest toe going out toward no man's land in that middle ground. And the other one, which is very interesting, is expanded playoff field in the postseason for 2020 and 2021. Because as you remember, back in early February, when you first wrote about this, at that time, the reaction from players overwhelmingly was like, nope, that's stupid. And Trevor Bauer was the most vocal about that. Nope, we're not going to be open to that. So it was kind of like, okay, here are two areas where maybe we're willing to do a little bit of give and take. Was that what your read was as well?
That's exactly what it was. And here's the thing. I don't know that the league's proposal to the players had any of those little lanyaps, for lack of a better word.
Right.
I mean, just these little offerings that really aren't altogether that consequential, but in the end represent something. And hopefully that's how the owners are taking them, that, hey, these guys may be on their idealist sides right now and trying to entrench, but that's just negotiating. That's just good negotiating. These little things that they included in here, and deferrals being the big one, are the more important thing to take away from this. And look, the deferrals were small, and they were conditional. It was $100 million of players who are making $10 million or more kept. I think the sense I got would be kept in kept it sort of a side fund at the end of the year. And if the playoffs are not played, then the owners get to keep that $100 million. And if they are, they come out of this escrow and go back to the players at that point. Now, the idea of the playoffs not being played would be awful for everybody involved, just because of the significant amount of money involved. And when you take that $100 million, it is fractional compared to the money that's going to be involved in the playoffs. So this is a small piece of a big piece, and that's just not going to work. But if they are open to deferrals, which of course they should be, Buster, because so many of the players who are even at the table have taken deferrals, because, you know, one of Scott Boras's biggest moves has been to get deferrals for his guys, whether it's Chris Davis, Steven Strasburg, even Max Scherzer.
Yeah.
All of these guys who have taken deferrals have shown that deferrals are not some inherent evil to the players. They're a tool that can be used. And this is a tool, I think, that could come in great handy right now.
Explain the notion, and I'm glad this was introduced to the table, because I want to make absolutely clear, I don't know what doctors are telling Carlos Carrasco of the Indians, but when I saw his great interview that he did with Pedro Gomez,
yep.
I just cringed for him. My sister, you know, had leukemia diagnosed on New Year's Eve in 2010. And as soon as the coronavirus broke out, she was the first person I called. I'm, Amelia, have you talked to doctors on how much more risk you're at? And the reality is that players like Carlos Carrasco, treated for leukemia, of course, last summer, and others are at heightened risk. So I'm glad that this is on the table. Can you explain what the thinking was in the side of the players?
Yeah, in the health and safety protocol draft that MLB sent over to the union, it included a group of players that they deemed high risk. And these were people like Carlos Carrasco, who have pre-existing conditions. These were family members who are at elevated risk for COVID-19 related problems. And it essentially said to them, we will give you a path to opt out of the season. Didn't talk about salary, didn't talk about any of the other things. The players wanted to really codify that anyone who has fears over coronavirus can sit out the season. Those who are high risk would be paid. And that, I think, is a reasonable ask. You can't help your health. You just can't. And I don't think baseball wants to be the sport that's putting anybody at risk. At the same time, if you opt out without one of those high risk conditions, then you would get your service time, but you would not get your salary. And I was honestly, Buster, a little bit surprised with that, because I felt like that was a place where the union was going to go after a couple back and forths. And that right there, to me, not asking for salary for players who sit out of their own volition was something of a give. And at this point, I don't know, maybe I'm just like looking for little things that could hope for a season at this point. But that was one I felt like could have turned into an issue that the players tried to use as a cudgel, and they didn't.
You made clear in your report that this is an offer, counterproposal that the owners are going to reject quickly. The first part that you mentioned, a schedule that starts on June 30th and goes until the end of October. Right away, I was like, there's no chance that the owners would ever agree to that. My sense is that on the owner's side, that there's a group of them at this point that kind of look at 2020 as, you know what? Let's try to get in some games. Let's try to move our product forward, get the postseason in, and then get out of Dodge. Because we've heard from Dr. Anthony Fauci and others that, yes, there is likely to be a return of the coronavirus in the fall. And so I feel like that on management side, they're trying to thread that needle. Let's have a representative regular season product, player postseason, but not risk too much and extend the schedule to go into the fall. Would you agree with me on that?
Yeah, the problem is we don't have crystal balls, man. And
yeah.
if you're And the sense that I've gotten is that that's being based on the second wave that we saw back in 1918. And the country is just such a different place right now in every regard than it was a century ago. And I know that's the best blueprint for what we're going through right now. But the idea that we can predict anything that's happening, I mean, I think the last week, the last month, the last 3 months have illustrated to us we have no agency. Like the world is going to do what the world is going to do, and we have to figure out how to live in it to the best of our ability. And I think that's why players are rejecting the notion of a shorter season or a second wave, because while that's a possibility, we just don't know enough in order to base something like that around it. So I think that their premise that you schedule as much as you can, you play as much baseball as you can, makes a lot of sense for their purposes and for what they're trying to do. And each side has staked out this position here where it's going to be interesting to see how they extricate themselves, to see what really was important. And I think, Buster, that games played is very important to the league. I think that owners honestly want to play as few as possible. And I'll be really curious to see if there's some sort of a lower game played, like a shorter season with a fuller amount of the pro rata that comes back to the players with this next one, where it essentially says, we're calling boo on your games played, but we understand that the pro rata is what matters most to you. So we're going to try and get as close to full on that as possible. And this is how it's economically feasible for us to do that. The problem with that is the shorter a season you have, the more you're running into the NBA, the NHL, yep, the NFL, and college football. And you have lost that great window at the beginning that you can use to show everyone, hey, guys, sports is back. Baseball's the first one back.
Boy.
As I wrote in the Sunday column, I don't think you can understate the impact of the failure to reach an agreement to play baseball in 2020. Look, if they were to start up and then it would be derailed by safety concerns, hotspots of coronavirus, that would be one thing. But if they failed to reach an agreement, that is the nuclear option that I think both sides should recognize. This is mutually assured destruction for Major League Baseball as we know it going forward, because if they don't reach an agreement now, then that whole question of player compensation in the face of coronavirus, all that is deferred, put off until next spring or over the winter. Mm-hmm. And then we'd be moving closer to the end of the collective bargaining agreement. And I have people on the player side say, yeah, that's on our side. One of our weapons would become the player strike. And on the owner side, there might be owners, including those ones that you and I have referred to, who already shut down 2020. They may be even more entrenched, saying, we've lost so much money. You know what? Let's wait out the players, wait out for a regime change. And then at the back end of this, yeah, there's going to be a lot of financial damage. But at least we probably would get to a financial model that we feel like we can grow the game with. And all the while, they're pissing off sports fans. They're pissing off baseball fans, yeah, and they're alienating, yeah, fans for years to come. Now, I can overreact. Maybe I tend to overreact. That's my read on it. What's your read on it?
My read on it is that it would be worse than 1994. It would be, I think I've used this phrase before, I think it would be catastrophically stupid to do that. But here's my concern, Buster. And I think this is a point that someone I was talking with this week illustrated really well. If the Los Angeles Angels are willing to gut their front office, if the Oakland A's are willing to gut their front office and not pay minor leaguers, if the Washington Nationals are willing to pay minor leaguers at three quarters of what they were before, if all of these things are true, then money is an incredibly large object to these clubs. And if money is an object with your own employees to these clubs, are you really going to be willing to bend at all when it comes to the players? That's my worry, that this whole idea, and I've been on this from the start, that they're going to play because the best alternative to a negotiated agreement is absolutely dreadful. But what if I've been naive about that the whole time? What if in reality, what these owners want is power? What if they are willing to wait out the money so they can wrest even more power over the sport going forward? You know, a point that you've made, and I think it's a really salient one here, is that players' average careers, like 3 to 5 years, somewhere in that range. Owners are in this for the long haul. And if the owners are using this to play the long game, where they say, yeah, we're going to punt on 2020, and we may even punt on 2021, but we punted on 1994, and by the time the 2000s came around, we were drawing 79 million people a year. If we can do that and put ourselves in a position long-term where we're the ones getting the majority of the revenue in baseball's inevitable comeback, you know, that's something that I think is a very realistic possibility. I think it would be missing that baseball wouldn't come back and wouldn't come back quickly and would lose fans all over the place. But I think it is a distinct possibility that something like that is in the works. And that is how baseball does not happen in 2020.
Man.
Listen, it's a dark thought, right?
But, oh, yeah.
But I think, here's the thing. The little signs are there for that not being just like a conspiracy theory, you know? I don't want to be too doomsday here, but I'm also at the point now where I don't want to be naive either. And the idea that baseball has to come back. No, it doesn't have to come back. It doesn't have to come back if the people in positions of power don't want it to. And they are not thinking like you and I are. These are investments that they have. These are family trusts in most cases. And 2020 is a single year and a shot year at that for people who are looking at it strictly from the perspective of finances and of an asset that they can pass down to family.
I worry that they're underestimating the damage that would do to baseball in general if that's what happened. So we'll see about that. You mentioned the doomsday thing. I before I did a radio hit on Saturday, I told the producers to have him bring me in as Dr. Doom, because the picture I'm going to paint is not a good one.
Buster, I also think it's important, by the way, that amid all of the gloom and doom, that we recognize history. And what history tells us is that in baseball negotiations in particular, in any labor negotiation, but particularly in baseball negotiations, nothing substantive happens until the last minute. The last minute is probably going to be this week. And that, I think, is where the real progress is going to be made. If there is not at least a step or two forward in the next couple of days, that's when you start getting a little nervous. But again, with the ticking clock, I want to wait until those ticks are getting toward the end, till those grains of sand are getting smaller and smaller. And that is when we'll have a true assessment of what's actually going on.
Who are the key people potentially involved in this you feel like can usher the two sides to a middle ground?
Oh, boy. You know, I look at somebody like Chris Young, and Chris Young is, MLB hired him, I think it was probably a year or two ago now, to be a liaison to players and to be somebody who has been a longtime part of the Players Association, a big voice in the Players Association, somebody who and people on the player side could talk to. And he's not a billionaire. He's not somebody who represents the ideals of owners. He's somebody who's there to hopefully bridge the gap. And I don't know if he by himself is going to be able to facilitate a collective bargaining agreement. You know, I think that when you have hardliners like Dick Montfort and Artie Moreno on the labor committee, on MLB side, that, you know, that's an important thing right there, and something that could be troublesome. But I think in the end, if you have somebody like Chris Young at the table, who's trying to get a sense of what players want and who's able to pass along to them what the point of this offer, whatever it is from MLB, is, that is something that can help. On the player side, isn't it in the end ultimately up to the players? Like, a lot of players are getting their opinions from their agent. That's just kind of the way that this has been. As much as the player representatives going back on those Zoom calls, you know, say what's going on, the players have been taking that information and bringing it to their agents. And there's a fair number of moderate agents out there who don't necessarily agree with some of the positions that Scott Boras and Bruce Meier have taken. And it'll be really interesting to see whether those agents and whether those players who share that same position step up and say, hey, time to make a deal here, guys. We've stood our ground hard enough, but in the end, we want to play.
Yeah, those forces of moderation are going to be the most important ones here over the next week. All right, Jeff, thanks for doing this. And I hope you get a little bit of sleep in the week ahead.
I will not, but I appreciate the sentiment, Buster. Thank you.
Numbers game.
Sarah Langs, a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, coming up soon, ESPN will run a documentary about the summer of 98, about Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa and their home run chase that year and what it meant for baseball. I'm curious about what you think about the narrative that those two guys with that and the interest that it generated, that essentially they saved baseball. What do you think?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm very excited to watch it, you know, always looking for more baseball content. And it's fun to have something coming up that we don't exactly know what they're going to say or what exactly is going to be in there. You know, obviously, I don't have a lot of firsthand memory of that summer. I mean, I did go to some games that year, and I was a baseball fan then, but I'm not sure that I was aware of the larger context at the time. I was pretty young. But I've learned a lot about that. And, you know, you learn in Ken Burns baseball and just reading and everything. And I do think that it definitely generated a lot of interest. You know, we talk about how, you know, Babe Ruth sort of saved baseball in 1920 after the 1919 World Series. And I've always sort of heard it as, you know, the mirror that the next time that happened was 1998 after 94, 95. And I do think there's merit to it in terms of, you know, the road attendances for the Cubs and the Cardinals in September were, you know, when they were on the road, when they were visiting a ballpark, those attendances were a lot, even from teams that were already out of it. And there was definitely a lot of interest in that. But I do think it was, I still get the sense that it was kind of isolated. I mean, the fact that it was the Cubs and the Cardinals, the fact that it was this one great rivalry does sort of take some other fans out of the equation, but it certainly didn't hurt from everything that I understand. But honestly, I'm curious your take, having witnessed it in a lot different way than I did.
Yeah, as we talked about when we had the conversation about Cal Ripken and 1995 and him breaking Lou Gehrig's consecutive game record, that there were a lot of factors that brought baseball back slowly. And it's been interesting as we've gone through this labor strife in baseball. I've heard from so many people who've been in the game about as long as I have saying it feels like that everyone's forgetting about how difficult it was after the 94-95 labor stoppage. Attendance dropped by about 20%. Ratings plummeted. And so I thought, you know, Cal's, you know, events of 1995, you know, the Yankees playing in the World Series in 1996, yep. You know, returning after, you know, what was it, 15 years away from the World Series, having a big market team. That was important to happen. The McGwire-Sosa home run chase, that definitely brought into it. And there's no question, sir. I remember I was covering the Yankees in 98, so that was most of my focus. But I was assigned one weekend by the New York Times to go and write about Mark McGwire in St. Louis, and those batting practice sessions, those were events. And Mark McGwire, he did an interview that I heard recently a few years ago with Mel Kiper and our friend Dari Noka about that year. And he remembers an executive, I think it was an owner on another team, basically coming to him and pleading him. Oh, it was John Henry, who at that time was the owner of the Marlins, going to him and pleading with him, look, can you please take batting practice? Because Mark was going to skip batting practice that day. And John Henry's like, you know what? Our fans have shown up to see that. So it was a big deal. Wow. Give me some numbers that you dug out on these two guys from that year.
Yeah, so these are a lot of fun. I mean, with so many home runs and all of that going on, there's so much to choose from. But so the first thing that I took a look at, you were actually asking me about this a couple weeks ago, was how many pitchers allowed a home run to each of them. Obviously, they're playing in the same division. You know, it stands to reason they're going to be a few. So Sosa homered off 58 different pitchers in 1998. McGwire homered off 65 different pitchers. And in total, 17 pitchers allowed at least one home run to each of them. I'm not going to read them all, but one of the fun names on here is Oral Hershiser. You've got Levon Hernandez there, and Jose Lima allowed 4 home runs total to the two of them combined, which is the most that any of those pitchers allowed. But then looking a little bit more just at their season and those home run breakdowns, so Sosa hit 4 homers at Milwaukee County Stadium, which is his most of any road park. He had 3 each off of Lima and off of Cal Eldred, which was his most off any pitcher. That latter 3 was in a 3-homer game, which was his only 3-homer game of the campaign off of Cal. He hit 20 home runs in June, which we know is the most in a single month in MLB history. Closest anyone's come since was Giancarlo Stanton with 18 in August 2017. And I think it's really interesting that the prior record before Sosa for most home runs in a single calendar month was Rudy York with 18 in August of 1937. So you talk about McGwire breaking Maris's record, which had stood since 1961. Sosa broke a record that had been there since 1937. I mean, that's not when we think of as having been even the previous wave of home run records. So I think that year really jumps off the page. Another thing with Sosa, though, is that, you know, I do, obviously McGwire broke the record and he hit the 70, but Sosa hit 292 home runs from 1998 through 2002. So that began with this season, which is the most by any player in a 5-season span in MLB history. And I just think that sometimes his end of it doesn't necessarily get lauded in quite the same way because he didn't break the record, you know?
And also, obviously, because of all the, you know, the questions that people have about him from that time. Sarah, I can remember in that summer of 98, as that chase was going on, one of the cool things was is that because one of the players was a Chicago Cub, a lot of the games were in the afternoon. So when we would go into the Yankees clubhouse for a pregame reporting, you'd always have the Cubs game on, and the players were talking about it, and they were well aware of it, and they were all over it and watching just like the rest of the world. It definitely, at that time, you know, captured the imagination, not only of fans, but also of players in the sport. It was awesome. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Monday. First one up from Amy Chapman at Amy R. Chapman writes in, on the Friday podcast, you mentioned that 6 owners would be fine with the Major League Baseball season getting canceled. Why are players, some but not all millionaires, are getting slammed, yet owners, all billionaires, aren't? I think we're seeing a little bit more of that this weekend, especially with, you know, the news of the Nationals rallying to, you know, support the minor leaguers.
Yeah, and I think in recent weeks, too, we had the conversation about the Pirates. I mean, cutting the 401k contributions, which saves them tens of thousands of dollars per month, okay? I mean, how ridiculous is that? And then what we saw from the Oakland Athletics last week, just dumping minor leaguers, declining to pay them as they go forward, that was awful. So I do feel like there at least has been some scrutiny on the owners.
For sure. And they certainly deserve it. I think it's just we, you know, we're guilty of it as a podcast. We see, you know, a shiny object. We see Blake Snell, you know, running his mouth. You know, we got to react to it. But, you know, there's certainly all blame to go around on all sides. Last one up for today, Brian Simpson at bsimp120274 writes in, wow, great interview regarding Holiday and the pain that pitchers must endure and how they cope with it. Gives me even more respect for Koufax for hanging it up when he did. What other prominent pitchers have ended their career very early due to this level of pain?
You know, I'm telling you, it's almost like too long of a list to get into, because I think the easier question is who didn't end their careers in pain. Seriously, when I go out, and I've told this story before, and I think it's repeating, when I bump into former pitchers, one of my questions to them is, it's like a natural health question. Hey, how you feeling? You know, how's your shoulder? Pitchers, obviously, that's their craft for 25 years. And yet it's so amazing to me how few pitchers, former pitchers, throw batting practice, Taylor. You go and you watch batting practice thrown. It's by former catchers. It's by former infielders. You know why? Because the former pitchers can't lift their arms above their shoulder level. The only pitcher, former pitcher who I know, who is a regular in the big leagues for a long time, who still throws batting practice, is Bud Black, the manager of the Colorado Rockies. Nobody else does because their arms are shot. And that's not something that happens without pain. It's a regular problem, much in the same way when I covered the New York Giants for 1 year, seeing all these former NFL players coming back and they're using walkers and they're riding golf carts and they're in their mid-40s because their knees and their legs and their hips are absolutely shot. And it's the same thing with pitchers and their arms.
Wow, that's pretty crazy. Thanks for shedding some light on that, Buster. Thanks for writing in, everyone. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And hopefully we can be, you know, very, very minor distraction given the state of the world.
Absolutely. My thanks today to Jeff and to Sarah and to Taylor. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great day and stay safe. Before we go, I really think it's important to take a moment. Listen to Myron Medcalf of ESPN Radio. I don't know him, but I heard him on radio on his show on Sunday morning. He lives in Minneapolis. His perspective on this is excellent. Give a listen.
That was not a police officer making a split-second decision, firing a weapon, and then us having a conversation about whether or not that was justified. This was 9 minutes, an opportunity to make a different decision, an opportunity to make a better choice, an opportunity to tell America that the life of this African-American matters. And when you see that video, Matt, it's impossible to think that you matter in this country. It's impossible to think that you have value in this country when someone can sit on you for that long. If we pause for 9 seconds right now in the middle of this show, people go, oh my goodness, how awkward is that? There's silence. People would call us and go, hey guys, it's silent on the radio right now. What happened? Now imagine 9 minutes. And when you see that, it's impossible to go, okay, people respect me in this country. I'm valued. Instead, you feel like, man, the same stuff that my grandfather was fighting for in Mississippi growing up as a sharecropper, the same thing my father was fighting for as one of the few African-American men on the University of Wisconsin campus. I'm dealing with the same stuff. I've got a lot of calls from some of my white friends and colleagues who genuinely are asking, well, what can I do? You know, they're saying, what can I do? I'm bothered. They're saying a lot of things you're saying, man. You know, this is emotional for me, and I want to be an ally, and I want to know how I can affect change. And I would say this to everybody, and I mean this respectfully. It's too easy to just have the conversation with me, right? Or people who look like me. That's the easy way out. I think until you can have uncomfortable conversations with those in your world who look like you, that's to me how you affect change. You've got to bring these conversations to your dinner table, to your sports bar, to your place of business, to your family gathering. Like that to me is how you really affect change, because having a conversation with someone like me and listening to me tell you about the experience of being black in America, we've heard these stories so many times. People understand what the reality is. You don't need a video to understand that, but will you take this moment and bring it to where you live? And when are you willing to risk relationships and friendships and whatever it may cost you to have difficult conversations and take a stand for what you say you believe in? You wonder if that's the same around the country in college basketball and college football. There aren't many black coaches, but certainly they're having these conversations. I wonder how many white coaches are having these same conversations with their players. You know, we've seen a number of statements, and I've had calls. Coaches have called me and said, hey, I'm concerned. What do I do? And I think it's good to announce that you feel the pain that some of your athletes are feeling, that America's feeling, that African-Americans are feeling. But I'll go back to the Christmas lights theory. At some point, this story will go away and we'll move on to something else. Are you going to continue to have those conversations? And I'll say this too, Matt. If this happens in September, I wonder if we're having a different conversation.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/PodCenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.